The following program is being brought to you on the Seventh Wave Network. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit SeventhWaveNetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit VoiceAmerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
I seek truth, no use sits within me. How deep would I go to find what I know about me? You don't know me like God does, like I do. I'm training myself to know how to sing, trust myself, believing everything, and I know I can keep up with my mind.
Welcome to Thresholds to Awakening with your host, Sway Emily Spilkin. Deep inside our greatest challenges live the seeds of our soul medicine, illness, trauma, loss, and crisis. If we enter them completely, can be gateways to the full embodiment of who we really are. Now, here is Sway Spilkin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Thresholds to Awakening, the show that helps you transform your deepest challenges into soul medicine. I'm your host, Sway Spilkin, and I am a body-centered psychotherapist in Boulder, Colorado, specializing in helping people transform through the thresholds of their lives, trauma, loss, illness, and other radical rites of passage. And today I have the great pleasure of speaking with Dr. Rick Hansen. And Dr. Hansen is a neuropsychologist and the author of Buddha's Brain, the Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom, and Just One Thing, Developing a Buddha Brain, One Simple Practice at a Time. He's the founder of Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom and affiliate of the Greater Good at UC Berkeley. And Rick's also been an invited speaker at Oxford, Stanford, Harvard. He's also taught in meditation centers worldwide. His work has been featured on the BBC, NPR, US News and World Report, and O Magazine. And he has several audio programs with Sounds True. His weekly newsletter, Just One Thing, has over 40,000 subscribers and also appears on Huffington Post, Psychology Today, and other major websites. And for more information, you can find Rick online at his full profile, www.rickhanson, and that's HANSON.net. So welcome to the show, Rick.
Great, Sway. Great to be here.
Thank you. And I'd love to give our listeners just a little bit of background. I would say about you in a nutshell that you teach people how to use the mind to change the brain in order to create more happiness, love, and wisdom, and that you teach a combination of brain science, psychology, and practical applied Buddhist spirituality. And these are the exact tools that people need in order to do what this show, Thresholds to Awakening, is about, which is to use our challenges as catalysts for growth. The tools that you teach really help people increase safety in the midst of challenge and increase their chances of being able to grow. So I just really want to thank you for being here and helping us with the practical hows of doing this.
That's great. By the way, that was a phenomenal summary. So I should be taking notes as you speak. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll email it to you so you can use that and just, you know.
That's good.
Pay me a small charge and then we'll...
There you are. Okay.
So for the first question, I think, you know, most of us think that we have no control over our state of being, our emotions, our mental states, that they just arise and that we can't actually do anything about them. But you teach that we actually can choose to grow our own happiness and well-being, and that this happens, as the title of your new book, Just One Thing, implies, one step at a time. So can you talk a little bit about this choice of happiness?
Oh, sure. First, as you know, professionally and personally, and I know both personally and professionally, and I bet everyone listening knows, if you take action in various ways, you can actually change things for the better, usually. The news, that's not news. The news is how that happens actually through the brain. and knowing what goes on inside the black box, you know, inside the 3 pounds of tofu-like tissue right between the ears. When you know more what's going on in there, then you can take skillful action better. Historically, people have known that, you know, for example, if they did various traditional spiritual practices or more recently, let's say in Western psychology, more, you know, psychoanalytic or more recent developments in terms of practice, that they got a certain result. But to some extent, honestly, all of us, me included, we're sort of fishing around in the dark. We kind of sort of knew, a little bit like the alchemists in the Middle Ages, that if you, you know, did X, you got Y. But we didn't know how it happened. But now more and more people actually know how mental practices, whether it's psychotherapy or somatic work or engaging a sense of the body's energies or traditional mindfulness meditation or practices like I teach, for example, in the Just One Thing book, such as taking in the good, really focusing on positive experiences, you know, turning a good moment into a great brain, et cetera, et cetera. When people do those things, research is showing increasingly with good, solid basis that you're actually changing your brain for the better. So to me, that's incredibly hopeful because it gives us a feeling that at a time when we feel kind of pushed around by the world and other people and our reactions to all of it, that we can actually be a hammer instead of a nail in one part of our life. We can actually change things for the better in a very, very intimate and embodied way. And so to me, that's a wonderful news at this stage in human history. We really need to get a critical mass of human brains, you know, going in a different direction, I think, to swerve away from the cliff we're racing toward right now. And it's so helpful to be able to know how to do these sorts of things right in the thick of everyday life, which is very much my own personal focus.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I especially love hearing the kind of the global impact of that, of, you know, it's like one brain at a time. If we, if we each really take responsibility and learn how to shift our own kind of neural patterns, then that cumulatively creates a whole different nervous system on the planet.
You got it.
And speaking of cumulatively, I'm wondering, you know, each of your specific practices, and we're going to talk about what they are because they're so juicy, but in the Just One Thing book, may seem small in and of itself, but cumulatively, each of those exercises really together over time can create a whole new brain. So I'm wondering if you can talk to our audience a little bit about that.
Oh, sure. It's really exciting, and it's obviously the ways in which the mind can change the brain, which then changes the mind itself for the better. And by mind, I mean that term very broadly to include the heart, our feelings, our hopes, our joys, our sufferings, our sorrows, all of it. Well, the ways that can happen, happen not just through any kind of formal practice, but in many, many everyday ways. One of my favorite examples is a study that was done on London taxi cab drivers who have to memorize the spaghetti snarl of streets there. And at the end of their training, a part of the brain called the hippocampus, I suddenly had a vision of dancing hippopotamuses running across a college. But anyway, hippocampus, there are two of them. There's two of almost everything in the brain. The convention, though, is just to speak of them in the singular, so that's what I'll do. But anyway, the hippocampus, very involved, as you know, in visual spatial memory, as well as some other important functions like putting things in context and calming down the alarm bell of the brain, the amygdala. Anyway, these taxicab drivers had measurably thicker cortex, neural tissue, in the hippocampus at the end of their training than they had at the beginning of their training. In other words, they worked that muscle, in a sense, in their brain, and as a result, naturally enough, it got bigger. And because it got bigger, they were more able to do more things with it. There's a famous saying in neuroscience, neurons that fire together, wire together. Yes. A modern update might be, there's a traditional saying in Buddhism that the mind takes its shape from whatever we rest it upon. And that's both good news and a cautionary tale when you think about the various places that people routinely rest their minds, including self-criticism, grumbling, regrets, and all the rest. On the other hand, the modern update would be that the brain takes its shape from what we rest the mind upon, so that if people, you know, worry a lot, engage a lot of anxious rumination, beat themselves up, focus on the ways that glass is half full, you know, the hole instead of the donut. Well, they're going to build a brain over time that's increasingly reactive to stress, less able to put things in perspective, more and more prone to depression and anxiety. That's the truth. On the other hand, if they alternately listen to you, Sway, or, you know, do other good practices in the world in which they are, for example, focusing on what's actually going well instead of badly, or observing the good facts in the world all around them, or doing practices to train their ability to exercise mindful attention or work with their emotions in skillful ways, well, they will build up different circuits in the brain, as studies show, where they become, for example, more tuned into themselves, more aware of the feelings of others, more able to exercise self-control, more resilient, less reactive as they go through life. In other words, they will build up supplies inside themselves, in their inner backpack, as it were, for the long and twisting and often difficult road of life. And that's the choice that we all have. You know, the brain is continually building structure. The only question is it building it for better or worse? And that's where the opportunities are becoming clearer, that we can actually take charge of that structure building process and build our own brain for the better.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. It's really so empowering because we can feel, I think that's what I was starting to say, the beginning of the show, you know, we can feel like, oh, I feel depressed and I don't have any control over it other than, you know, taking this medication or doing this. But actually the very place that we put our attention on, you know, it's like, or this terrible life thing is happening to me. And depending on how we attend to this really difficult experience in our life, we're actually shaping our brains. So the place that we have control is not necessarily over the primary experience, but over how we then attend to that experience with our thoughts and our awareness.
Exactly right. You said it really well. Things happen to us, but we have so many capacities to, you know, in a sense, intervene with a shock absorber. And, you know, what's in the mind in this instant is unchangeable because it's, you know, congealed into actuality, as it were. But we do have a range of influence over the next several seconds, if not the next minute or so. And we can continue to condition the mind stream bit by bit in a more positive direction. You know, as they say in Tibet, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves. I do want to say, if I could, something as a, you know, I'm a longtime mindfulness practitioner and Buddhist teacher, and there's, I think, a misunderstanding that's emerged in the world of consciousness, non-dual thinking, Western Buddhist practice, and frankly, in a lot of mindfulness-based interventions and the ways in which they've influenced psychology. And the misunderstanding is to equate mindfulness with a particular stance toward the contents of mind. In other words, basically, there are three things you can do with the mind. There's three great ways to engage the mind. One, we can be with what's there. Two, we can reduce the negatives. Three, we can increase the positives. That's it. There's no fourth. You know what I mean? And all are incredibly important. The first is the most important of all, being able to be with it, witness it, feel the feelings, experience the experience, bear the pain, and as well, be with the joys, you know, the wonderful things. That's fundamental because you cannot always work with the mind. You cannot always reduce the negatives or increase the positives, but you can always be with what's there. On the other hand, mindfulness is to be present in all stances. In other words, whether we're just being with the stream or pulling the weeds, if you will, in the garden of the mind or planting flowers, we need to be mindful in all cases. And just being with the mind is not the only way to practice with it. Sometimes, honestly, you got to roll your sleeves up and get into the garden and take initiative, take action in your mind. I have to say that for every one person I've ever known who got way too busy trying to fiddle and fix their mind, there were 10 people I knew who were just way too passive and way too jerked around by and hijacked by their reactions, way too pulled by the puppet strings of the mind. You know, so I'm a big believer that You know, how can I put it? The brain is constantly changing its structure. We're bombarded by all kinds of crazy stuff these days. We live very fast-paced, stimulus-overwhelmed, stressful lives that the brain did not evolve to handle. And meanwhile, the brain is very much governed by ancient systems, caveman, cavewoman systems, reptile systems, little rat systems, little monkey systems that were great for survival in very harsh conditions over millions and hundreds of millions of years in terms of mammalian evolution, but which today in the 21st century, as I've said, are driving the planet over the brink, and as well as creating a lot of suffering in everyday lives across dinner tables or in bedrooms or in boardrooms. So to me, it's not appropriate to just sit back and passively, as it were, in some kind of exalted non-dual state. If you can get there, great. And, you know, if you can make it last forever, great. But meanwhile, here on planet Earth, where most of us live every day stuck in traffic or trying to get a toddler into a car seat or work something out with a partner or deal with financial worries or care for aging parents or watch the evening news, it's not enough to simply be with the mind. It's also important to work with it as well.
Thank you for that. Feels like what you're talking about is taking up our individual responsibility for our lives by actually choosing to work with our minds and brains in a very active way, moment to moment, in order to make a difference in our lives.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry for my soapbox, but I just think it's so important. I know a lot of people who somehow feel guilty. I frankly had a fair amount come at me where people say, oh, that's not mindfulness. Well, yeah, it is. You can be mindful if you're being active or not, you know. And also people have this kind of stance somehow that the perils, the pitfalls of taking action inside the mind are so great that we shouldn't dare do it. Well, there are a lot of pitfalls in just standing idly by, you know, as various tendencies run through the mind. And since the brain is very, very sponge-like, and it's also got a negativity bias, it's super spongy for the negative. It's very absorbent for the negative. Well, if you just sort of let those states of mind hang out in your brain, they're going to gradually stain it, in a sense. They're going to sink into it because neurons that fire together wire together, and they do so preferentially for negative states of mind. So, it's again, to me, it's not enough to just sort of let those states persist if they're persisting. Sometimes they pass away when you bring just open, spacious, non-interfering awareness to them. Great. But often they don't just pass away, and then it's time to roll up your sleeves and get into the garden.
Yes. Yeah, I love it. It's not a soapbox. It's really necessary, I think, for many of us to hear. And specifically because of this, what you call a negativity bias, it actually takes work. We can't just, you know, be present and hope that our brain will shift. It actually takes, as you really write about and offer us, a conscious effort to change our brains for the good, and you know, it's necessary for people to know that.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm wondering, you know, because of this negativity bias, does it actually take more positive experiences to counter one negative habit?
Yeah. The short answer is yes. The explanation is this. If you think about it, as we evolved, rule one in the wild is eat lunch today, don't be lunch today. Or to put a little differently, you know, if you've got to get carrots and avoid sticks, if you fail to get a carrot today, you'll have a chance at a carrot tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid a stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. So even though the great majority of moments for, you know, a lizard, a rat, a monkey, a caveman, cavewoman, were either neutral or positive, neutral, or let's call them pleasant, or I'll just call them positive, the occasional moments that were negative had intense urgency and impact. So the brain evolved to pay a lot of attention to those kind of moments and store them immediately in emotional memory. Once burned, twice shy. While positive moments have standard issue memory systems. So therefore, unless an experience is very novel or intense, a positive experience, it basically needs to be held in short-term memory buffers 5, 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row to depending on the person and the situation, for it to be transferred out of those short-term memory buffers to long-term storage. But how often do we actually do that? How often do we actually savor or deliberately stay with, particularly as an embodied experience, in other words, sensate and emotional? How often do we actually stay with the sense of feeling cared about, let's say, when someone smiles at us, or a sense of the beauty of the world when we go out and we see the, you know, the sun is shining, it's a nice day, or how often do we stay with the experience of some good quality inside ourselves, a sense of inner strength or grit, determination, decency, fairness? Or how often do we actually savor the experience of everyday accomplishments, like finishing a load of laundry or sending out a batch of emails? No, most people, you know, they're on to the next thing, partly because we're so bombarded these days by various demands that are dragging us willy-nilly onto the next thing. Well, what that means, though, is that even though it was a momentarily, subjectively positive experience, from the standpoint of building structure in the brain, the standpoint of learning, of making actually a change that's lasting, it may as well never have happened at all. It was utterly wasted on the brain. And meanwhile, those occasional or sadly in some people's lives far from occasional and ongoing negative experiences, wham, get immediately encoded into neural structure. Right, which is the so-called negativity bias of the brain. If you think about it, maybe think about a relationship. You know, 10 things happen in a day. What's the one you remember? It's the one that was irritating. Or, as you know, a lot of research on couples has found, if couples drop below a 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative interactions, that's an incredible risk for breaking up, including divorce. So it's as if a single negative interaction was as powerful as 5 positive ones. That's why, for me, the takeaway is to not be afraid of the negative, but to realize that negative interactions, negative experiences, negative moments have a lot of impact. And after you've had an appropriate amount of time of simply being with it, it's time to kind of help it move on and get out of Dodge. And meanwhile, as a cautionary tale, if you're interested in, you know, building up the roots of your own well-being, and also helping your own body and mind to step out of the stress cascades and with its very pernicious effects in terms of stress chemistry, and develop long-term health and therefore longevity, well, that immediately turns you toward positive experiences and taking in the good, which is how I talk about it, to get them, to install them into neural structure.
I love, as you speak about it, I'm getting the sense that the good is an actual substance. Like there's this, you know, energy or thing of life, the substance of life called good or goodness, and that we have a choice in any given moment to just, to, you know, take it when it comes and, you know, or actually turn towards it, be in relationship to it, cultivate that relationship, feed it. And as we do that, then that actually changes the structure of our brain. Do you know that story about the this kind of question of, you know, there are two wolves fighting?
Oh, yeah.
Right? So it's can you tell that story?
Oh, sure. No, I was jumping on enthusiastically. It's actually a chapter in my book, Buddha's Brain, and it's this ancient story. The way I heard it is this way. A Native American elder was asked at the end of her life, "Grandmother, how have you become so popular, loved? How have you become so admired and respected? How have you become so happy? We want to learn from you." And she paused for a moment and said, "Well, you know, it's because I've always known my entire life that there are two wolves in my heart, one wolf of love and one wolf of hate. And I've known every day that everything depends on which one I feed."
Love that. And so really what you're teaching, bottom line, is how to feed the wolf of love.
That's exactly right. We cannot kill the wolf of hate because trying to kill it feeds it, right? But what we can do is we can put it on a juice fast and restrain it and draw on it if we ever need it, you know, at times more broadly, moving on the word hate, when we really need to draw upon some sense of healthy aggression, if that's not an oxymoron, some sense of outrage maybe at the way the world is, or really sticking up for someone we care about. But generally be very, very careful about that wolf of hate. And meanwhile, as you say, really, really focus on and take responsibility for continuing to feed the wolf of love.
Beautiful. We're going to take a break, Rick. And when we come back, I'd love to speak a little bit about some of the specific practices that you offer in your new book. So we'll do that.
Great.
Find out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network. Find out about new shows, featured guests, and what's up this week. Find us on Facebook by searching keyword Voice America.
What are the benefits to combining modern science with ancient healing practices? For the answers, you'll want to tune into Frame of Mind with your host, Terry Sue. Each week, our program focuses on ways to live more holistically. By developing new ways of looking at our world, we can find ways to foster harmony and peace for the good of mankind and our planet. If we learn to live and think healthier, we begin to explore and focus on our strengths. Tune into Frame of Mind, Saturdays at 12 noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on Seventh Wave Network.
Being Here with Ariel and Shia Kane is an ordinary person's guide to modern-day enlightenment. This show is an exciting exploration which opens the door to living in the moment. Don't miss Being Here. Tune in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon Eastern with Ariel and Shia Kane, right here on the Seventh Wave Network.
Step into the doorway to conscious choice, greater health, and well-being. Attain the balance that you've been seeking. Tune in and turn on 1111 Talk Radio. Feed the mind. Embrace positively. Release the tension. Step out of fear. Host Simran Singh will help you broaden your mind and open your heart toward a greater understanding of how to take charge of your life. 1111 Talk Radio is here every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time on Seventh Wave Network. 1111 Talk Radio, because shift happens. The Seventh Wave Channel on the Voice America Network. You are tuned into Thresholds to Awakening with Sway Emily Spilkin. You are welcome to connect with Sway anytime via email at sway@hotmail.com. That's sweigh@hotmail.com. Or go to her website, thresholdstoawakening.com. Now, back to this week's program.
Hi, we're back with Thresholds to Awakening and our guest, Dr. Rick Hansen. And we are going to talk now in the second half of the show about how do we actually change our brains for cultivating goodness? What are the practices? And in your new book, Rick, Just One Thing, you have 52 of these practices. So if we wanted to really deepen, you know, take a week with each one, we could. And some of the practices you talk about are taking in the good, savoring pleasure, feeling safer. And you call these practices experience-dependent neuroplasticity practices, which, you know, as a somatic therapist, I can kind of geek out on and really like. But
you ought to be careful about that.
Okay, careful about geeking out. Yes, it's true.
Yeah.
But can you tell people, what do you mean by that? What are these practices? And what are some of your favorites?
Oh, good. What? This is one of my favorite questions. Well, a couple things. First, the phrase, quote, experience-dependent neuroplasticity, which is a mouthful, is a standard phrase in the field. It's not my own. And it simply means that the brain is constantly changing its structure. That's neuroplasticity. Plasticity just simply means changeability, as people know. And we're speaking here of those changes that are based on conscious experience. All right, and in particular, let's say more embodied experience, emotions, feelings, which probably makes you as a somatic therapist jump up and down for joy. But anyway, so that's point one. Point two, a very important point here, in a frame in which, quote-unquote, neurons that fire together wire together, frankly, the more neurons you can get firing and the longer they're firing and the more intensely they're firing, right, and the more actively they're firing and with regard to more associations they're firing, well, you're going to get a lot more wiring. You're going to build up a lot more structure. It's a little bit, again, like working a muscle. The different ways you work that muscle, the more frequently you do it, the greater appropriate intensity you bring to bear, how you kind of manage the process of working out and so forth is just going to create more results. The same is true for your own brain. So I'll give you a couple examples of things that I personally find luscious practices, really delicious practices. Number one is, as I've said, the practice of taking in the good. That's the second chapter in my Just One Thing book, which is these little short 52 practices you can do. I actually got complimented on a radio show I did where the fellow said, this is like a bathroom book, and I felt fine. You read. Exactly right, dude. But anyway, and then also Taking in the Goods, the fourth chapter in Buddha's Brain, so people can go there if they want to learn more about these practices. Okay, the basic idea is you want to activate a positive state of mind in the first place, which means that you're activating some underlying neural state, because mental and neural states arise together. The brain is representing the mind. That may sound exotic, but if you think about it, there are millions of examples every day around in which we're dealing with this. Think of a stoplight, you know, a traffic light. Red, yellow, and green are physical in some sense, material, let's call them that, E equals MC squared, but what they represent, what they mean, the meaning of the red wavelengths, the meaning of the yellow wavelengths, and so forth, is constructed. It's not physical. You can't touch it, right? Yet, it's there. It exists, but it's of a different order of existence than materiality. Okay, so we have a mental state, which is to say a thought, a feeling, a sensation in the body, a sight, a sound, a joy, a sorrow, what have you. We have a mental state that is co-occurring with, correlating with, co-arising with an underlying neural state. So far, so good. That's step one. We got to get a good experience going in the first place with its underpinnings in the brain. And then step two, we want to extend it. We want to savor it. We want to stay with it. So we get a lot of neurons firing together. And step three, we want to sense and intend that we're absorbing this experience. It's sinking into us, which primes memory systems and makes them more receptive. So to kind of summarize, if you imagine an acronym here, first step, have the experience. That's the A. Have the experience in the first place, either because you notice you're already having one, which is most common, or, if appropriate, create it. Think of something positive. Think of something to be grateful about. Bring to mind someone that you know cares about you. Bring to mind an awareness of your own good qualities. Think about a recent event that made you happy. Think about something that makes you happy, period. I think about my kids or Tuolumne Meadows. I live in California. And I've been to Yosemite a lot. Anyway, these are different ways to have that positive experience. That's the H. Then extend it. That's the E. Then absorb it. That's an A. H-E-A. So far, those are the three fundamental steps of taking in the good. And then if you want, very powerful, but a little tricky, fourth optional step, pair that positive experience with some kind of negative material, so that gradually, as neurons that fire together wire together, the benefits of that particular positive experience infuse, they get woven into, they penetrate, they soothe that negative material, even to the point of gradually, utterly uprooting it, pulling the tip of its root, and instead replacing it with something positive. So those are the three fundamental steps of taking in the good. Sounds complicated, but 10 seconds, a dozen seconds at a time, basically. Once you get used to doing it, you have dozens of opportunities every day to take in the good.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'd love to kind of show this example with another practice in the book and kind of walk through it. And specifically what there's a few different ones that jump to mind. And one of them is that I love is taking refuge, which is really a Buddhist concept. I used to live at a Zen center in California and we would, you know, chant the refuges, taking refuge. But you in the book really shift it from an idea to an actual felt sense experience, yeah. Which is really what is creating the new neural pathway, you know, that, or that new kind of wiring of, you know, what do we take refuge in and what's the actual experience inside our bodies of feeling that sense of safety that comes with the taking refuge. So can you walk us through that using that kind of example, that acronym that you gave us a minute ago?
Oh, sure. Thank you. Well, first off, with regard to refuge, which is, you said, is also one of the chapters in Just One Thing, we all need refuge, right? We all need someone to lean on, as they say. I think about in ancient times, there were always these sacred places, including if you could just get there, you were safe from being attacked. The way we typically talk about refuge is that it's something we go to, so it's dualistic, it's out there, it's distant. Well, okay, there's a place for that, if you will, but I think it's actually more powerful to get a felt sense of being in refuge already, or a felt sense of what it would be like to be in that refuge. You know, so for example, let's suppose that a person has a sense of refuge in a teacher or a teaching, let's say. So they might say, you know, I go to refuge in traditional terms in the Buddha, as you know, or other ways of other teachers, if a person likes. Or a different way to feel it is, you know, in a sense, abiding in Buddha nature, here I am, right? Or simply abiding as Buddha. You know, as Jack Kornfield says, you know, it can be annoying to be Buddhist, but everyone appreciates a Buddha. Anyway, so, you know, or other refuges that I personally take, things like, you know, abiding as awareness rather than going to awareness, or abiding as practice rather than going to practice. So what a person might do, maybe someone listening right now, is they might get a sense of something that for them is a very meaningful refuge, and then bring up the felt sense of what it's like to feel as if you've come home to that refuge. You're living, you're breathing in that refuge. The refuge is breathing you, if you will. The refuge is in your heart, radiating outward, inside out. That's the case. It's already the case. You're already home, breathing in, breathing out, already here. That would be an example, Sway, of doing this kind of practice. And for me, you know, something very important happened in my own practice, my personal practice, when I started routinely taking refuge and finding my own, you know, to add to some traditional ones, you know, ones that were personally meaningful to me. And I nominate that to people. It takes a minute or two if you want to do it. You can do it. You can take longer with it. But you just kind of work your way through it. You want to get a felt sense of each one, a sense of arriving in it, abiding in it, and coming from it and having, in a sense, it live you or give over, you're giving over to it, as it were. It is carrying you along, this particular refuge. That's a very powerful practice. And as you well know, as a somatic therapist, the more that it's sensate, the more that it's actually kind of in your belly, in your feet, in your face, in your throat and eyes, the more neurons you're going to be firing together, and the more you're going to be building up that resource inside yourself.
I love that. And it makes sense. It just seems so simple, but that's something that feels so good, you know, that abiding in and giving over and feeling yourself being held and breathed by this something larger than you that you're taking refuge in, that is so good for us, you know, and that's, I think that's true about all these practices, gratitude and pleasure and feeling safety, everything that you have in the book, all the 52 practices, that they actually feel so good in the moment I wonder, in a way, it's like if that's our brain's, kind of reward system to keep us doing it.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. You're naming a very important point here, which is that, as Joseph Goldstein says, you know, he's a very senior American Buddhist teacher, everything rests on the tip of motivation, whichever way we lean. And, you know, for what it's worth, as the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago as a critique of the practices of his time that were very focused on mere behavior, mere kind of empty ritual or potentially empty ritual, the Buddha emphasized that the fundamental source of karma, broadly meaning effects, in other words, causes have effects, right? Certainly in this life and, you know, potentially in other ones. Anyway, the central source, the primary factor in the development of effects, karma, if you will, is our own intention. So intention is critically important, motivation, intention, and so forth. It's easy to be motivated to do the things that already feel good, that we want to do, right?
Yeah.
The trick in life, a lot, is to motivate ourselves to do the things that are good for us that we don't want to do. You know,
yes.
We don't want to give up the second donut or the fifth. You know, right? We don't want to do that long run. We don't, when we're mad, we don't want to not, you know, yell at the person. We want to do it. We want to go there. When we're out with friends partying, whatever, we don't want to not have that third beer or glass of wine or whatever. And so then the question becomes how to help ourselves. And that's where, to your point, reward is so useful. And one of the most powerful ways to use, for example, the technologies, in some sense of that word, of taking in the good, the methods of taking in the good, it's to pair, it's to associate the either current experience that's positive related to some behavior you want to support, or to pair, associate anticipated rewards from some behavior you want to support, so that increasingly your mind will naturally lean in that direction because you've trained your brain to pursue those rewards, and that's what it will do in the future.
Yeah. You know, I want to talk with you a little bit about how in a moment where we actually aren't in a state where it comes easily, you know, how, as in your book, you in Just One Thing, you talk about this improvisational game, which I love. I found this in the book because I've used this example before, so it made me so happy to see it there. Of this, you know, in an improv game, when someone comes into the scene, you know, and they offer us something strange, like, "Hey, take this handlebar," or you know, whatever it is, we have to go with it, or we kill the scene, right? So in improvisation, if we say no to it, then we have to create something else to keep the scene going, versus actually say yes to it and be with it, even if in the moment we don't like it. And so you talk about this, about saying yes to life and saying yes to what we like and to what we don't like, and how that actually also can train our brain for the good. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about that here.
Okay. Well, let's see, a couple things. So first of all, in the brain, as I say, there's this negativity bias. It's a term that's used in science, negativity bias. So the brain is very inclined to say no. And people can simply do a practice, which I mentioned in the book, of say yes, you know, look around the room, say yes to one thing or another, or imagine saying yes to various things, and then try just saying no to the same things, and then notice how it feels in the body to go from one mode to another mode. Generally speaking, yes feels a lot more open and spacious, and that no seems to have a real kind of impact. So I think it's important to be kind of careful in the brain with our no's, or using the language of Buddhism, with our aversion, with our distaste or dislike for what feels or we think might be unpleasant. So point one. Point two, if you, in effect, how can I put it? If something has happened, it carries its own yes. Reality is saying yes. Yes, you know, yes, someone ran a red light. Yes, there is a headache. Yes, teenagers are surly, right? Yes, toddlers don't want to be put into car seats. Yes, someone is saying something whose politics you don't like. Yes, people are starving to death worldwide, tragically. none of these yeses, but in other words, these are happening. It's reality. So if we say yes to them, not that we're approving, right? We're not voting on what reality is. We're simply acknowledging the truth. We're stepping out of ignorance and delusion to face the actual truth of things. On the other hand, if we say no to the way reality is, we're in delusion. Because guess what? Reality ain't that way. Reality is the way it is. So the saying yes deeply aligns us with reality, which fundamentally, you know, is the basis of mental health as well as spiritual practice and certainly, you know, modern science. Also, when we say yes, in effect, it helps us come to peace with the way it is. It's not that we prefer it. It's not that, you know, it's easy to say yes to the ice cream cone, right? It's saying yes to the flat tire. It's saying yes to the fact that we've developed arthritis. It's saying yes to the fact that someone we wish would love us more doesn't love us more. But when we do that, there's a kind of peace to it. I mean, again, I'm picking up on Buddhist psychology, not because I'm trying to pitch it, but because I'm just using it as a source of ideas, and people can judge for themselves if they're, you know, worth anything. That said, the Buddha distinguished between what he called the first and second darts. The first darts of life are the things that feel unpleasant. There's inherent discomfort, physical and mental, in life, let's say, including, let's say, someone who we wish would love us and they don't love us in the ways or as much or at the times that we'd like to be loved. All right? The first dart hurts. Ouch. It is what it is. But then, so much of the time, we add second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, 28th starts to it that we throw ourselves. We get into our reactions to the event. I wish I had more love. Why can't they love me the right way? What did I do wrong? I'm a horrible person. No one will ever love me. Because I'm too fat. I had a pimple. It's terrible. Whatever. You know, we really get into it. All men are like that. Or women, what have you. Or beyond gender. Anyway, then we add our reactions to it. And saying yes to the way it is cuts through all those second, third, fourth, fifth dart cascades. Because then we're just left with, yes, this hurts. Yes, I feel sad. Yes, I feel mistreated. Yes, I wish it was different. And that's right there the beginning of cutting the chain of suffering.
I love that. And, you know, related to that, but slightly different. So there's saying yes to what is happening. And then there's also faith in kind of the larger picture, even if we don't like what's happening. And faith, because of the topic of this show, you know, which is really about thresholds, our challenges, right? Our real kind of difficulties in our lives. Faith is, you know, tends to be a question that I bring up a lot. And I'm really wondering, this will be kind of our last question right here towards the end, but how can people really cultivate faith when, and a faith that life is on our side, even though we think we have evidence that it's not? And then what's actually happening in our brains when we do cultivate that kind of faith?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. Well, a couple of things. I think it helps to define terms, you know. So I'm going to distinguish here between, if you will, faith in that which is unverifiable, or then we're getting into the word, what do we mean verify? But, you know, in conventional terms. In other words, people have just a belief, and they know you can't prove it in any kind of conventional sense, but they have a conviction, a belief that in something or other, whatever it may be, classically the divine. And by the way, for the record, you know, I have a faith in that myself. I have both an experience and I would say a reasoned conviction about the existence of the transcendental. That said, now I'm going to speak within a different frame in terms of those things that we can actually verify in ordinary conventional ways. I'll use maybe the word conviction. And so, you know, the world is scary. It's uncertain. It's full of crazy ups and downs. Many people disappoint. It's easy to feel kind of bamboozled and or perplexed. What in the world is going on? Or to lose confidence, really. You know, as you know, I think, the word confidence at root, it comes from confide in the Latin, which means with faith. In other words, that we have conviction or reasoned hope or belief in something. So having faith is really, really important. And so I really encourage people to appreciate, for example, all the little ways in a day that tend to flow right through the brain, like water through a sieve, in which they actually got something done, or they actually were able to muster some capacity to deal with whatever it was, including something that was difficult. And so on the basis of actually registering all these many examples of being a hammer instead of a nail, all these many examples of being able to have good moments. You know, coffee tastes good. Chocolate is great. Children are laughing. Ain't dead yet, right? These are real opportunities to build up a sense of almost a kind of muscular confidence or conviction inside that I can make my way in this world, even though it's often difficult. Flip the other way around. Think of all the things that could have gone badly that didn't. You know, we notice the one bad thing that goes wrong. We ignore the 10,000 things that could have gone wrong, but in fact went right. And so there, too, is an opportunity for people to develop as they go through the day a sense of conviction. Another one I talk about in the book, actually, is to notice you're all right now. Mother Nature is continually lying to us. Look out, look out, look out. She wants us to be just a little anxious all the time to keep us vigilant. And for some people, for various reasons, temperament, trauma, what have you, they're more than a little anxious all the time. But most of that anxiety is a false alarm. On the other hand, there's an ongoing signal in the body, or signals, plural, many signals, that are coming up into the brain that are telling us moment to moment, actually, all is well. Mm-hmm. The heart's beating, there's enough air, digestion's occurring. Your body is basically all right now. It may not be all right in the future. It may not have been all right in the past. But in this moment, most moments for most people, most days, you're actually all right now. And feeling it, registering it as a feeling, can really build up your conviction that you can go through life with faith and confidence, that you can live long and prosper.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Rick. We're right here at the end, and that's a perfect way to end this segment. And I just want to thank you so much for being here today. Again, people can find you online at www.rickhansen.net. And you can find me in the Thresholds to Awakening show on the Thresholds to Awakening fan page on Facebook, and also www.thresholdshealing.com. Thank you, Rick, for being here. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Sway.
Thank you again for joining us this week. Thresholds to Awakening can be heard live every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific Time, on the Voice America 7th Wave Channel. Please join Sway Emily Spilkin then, and have a great week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the 7th Wave Network. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit 7thWaveNetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.